Part 1, The Origins of Satan. Better to reign in hell than serve in heaven. Milton, Paradise Lost. The name Satan comes from a Hebrew word meaning adversary. In the older books of the Old Testament, written before the Jews were carried away into exile in Babylon in the 6th century B.C., a Satan is merely an opponent. The angel of God stood in the way for an adversary, Satan, against Balaam. A Satan was not necessarily supernatural. The Philistines refused to accept David because they were afraid he would turn his coat in battle and become their Satan or adversary. In two later passages written after the exile, the Satan appears. He is an angel and a member of God's court who acts as an accuser of men before God. In the book of Zechariah, possibly dating from the late 6th century B.C., the prophet sees Joshua the high priest standing before God to be judged. The Satan stands at Joshua's right hand to resist him or argue the case against him. There is already a suggestion that the Satan is excessively zealous as a prosecutor because God rebukes him for accusing a righteous man. In the first two chapters of Job, perhaps written about 100 years after Zechariah, the Satan is still the accuser of men, and he now seems definitely malignant. The sons of God present themselves before Jehovah, and the Satan is with them. In words which were probably intended to have an ominous ring, the Satan says he has come from going to and fro in the earth and from walking up and down in it. Jehovah praises Job as a righteous man, but the Satan argues that it is easy for Job to be faithful to God because he is happy and prosperous. As a test, Jehovah allows the Satan to kill Job's children and his servants and his cattle, but Job refuses to curse God for these catastrophes, saying philosophically, "The Lord gave, and the Lord hath taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." The Satan is not at all content with this. "Skin for skin, yea, all that a man hath will he give for his life. But put forth thine hand now, and touch his bone and his flesh, and he will curse thee to thy face." Jehovah lets the Satan afflict the unfortunate Job with a plague of sore boils all over his body, but Job still remains faithful. In this story, the Satan is determined to destroy Job's credit with God, and he is the direct instrument of Job's punishment. But he acts only under God's instructions, and he is felt to be performing a useful function. He tries to bring to the surface the wickedness inherent in men. Later, it was thought that the Satan's malicious zeal must make him as repulsive to God as he was to man. In 1 Enoch, a Jewish book which is not included in the Old Testament, but influenced the early Christians, there is a group of Satans who by this time are not welcome in heaven at all. Enoch hears the voice of the archangel Phanuel, fending off the Satans and forbidding them to come before the Lord of Spirits to accuse them who dwell on the earth. There are also angels of punishment, who seem to be identical with the Satans. They are seen preparing instruments of punishment for the kings and the mighty of this earth, that they may thereby be destroyed. These passages were probably written in the 1st century B.C. It was from this notion of an implacable angel who accuses men and punishes them that the devil of medieval and modern Christendom eventually grew. When the Old Testament was first turned into Greek, the Satan was translated as diabolos, meaning an accuser, with the implication of a false accuser, a slanderer, and this is the word from which our devil comes. Later Jewish writers tended to separate good and evil and to see Jehovah as entirely good. They found the actions of Jehovah in some biblical stories distinctly unedifying, and so they put them down to an evil angel. When the story of David numbering Israel and God's vengeance for this crime was first told in 2 Samuel, which may date from the early 8th century B.C., Jehovah puts the idea of taking the census into David's mind. But when the same story is retold in 1 Chronicles, possibly written in the 4th century B.C., it is Satan who is responsible. "And Satan stood up against Israel and provoked David to number Israel." This is the only use of Satan as a proper name in the Old Testament. In later Jewish writings and in Christian theory, the figure of Satan becomes clearer and his powers are magnified until he is the great opponent of God and man, almost, but never quite, beyond God's control. It was natural for people to wonder how the Satan, originally a valued, if unpleasant, official of God's court, had fallen from grace to become God's enemy. One explanation was found in the story of the Watchers, the germ of which appears in Genesis. When the race of men began to increase in numbers, the sons of God saw the daughters of men that they were fair, and they took them wives of all which they chose. In those days there were giants in the earth, and the daughters of men bore children by the angels, which became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. The story may have been meant to account for the supposed existence of giants and heroes in early times, but intentionally or unintentionally, the next verse connected it with the coming of evil to the earth. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. It was because of this that God decided to destroy mankind in the flood. There are several possible references to this story in other Old Testament books, but the first full version of it in its later form is given in 1 Enoch in passages probably written in the 2nd century B.C. And it came to pass, when the children of men had multiplied, that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters. And the angels, the children of the heaven, saw and lusted after them, and said to one another, Come, let us choose wives from among the children of men, and beget us children. These angels were of the order of watchers, the sleepless ones. Their leader was Semjazer, or, in other passages, Azazel. 200 of them descended to earth on Mount Hermon. They took wives, and they began to go in unto them, and to defile themselves with them. They taught their wives charms and enchantments, botany and the cutting of roots. Azazel taught men to make weapons of war, swords and knives and shields. He also introduced the evil art of cosmetics. Their human wives had children by the watchers, great giants who ate up all the possessions of men. And when men could no longer sustain them, the giants turned against them and devoured mankind, and they began to sin against birds and beasts and reptiles and fish, and to devour one another's flesh and to drink the blood. God sent the archangel Raphael to imprison Azazel in the desert till the last judgment, when he was to be hurled into eternal fire. The other watchers were made to look on while their children, the giants, were killed. Then God told the archangel Michael to bind the angels in the valleys of the earth until the day when they would be cast into everlasting torment in an abyss of fire. But the earth was not purged of evil. Demons issued from the bodies of the dead giants and have remained in the world ever since, causing wickedness, destruction, and oppression. One passage sympathetically suggests that the sin of the angels was not so much lust as a longing to enjoy the comforts of family life, as men do. And this is the first hint of a theme which was developed later, the idea that some of the angels were jealous of man. God explains to the angels that because they are immortal and need no descendants, they have not been given wives and children. But to later ages, the point of the story was that evil and bloodshed and forbidden arts came to earth through an appalling crime against nature, the physical union of the angelic and divine with the mortal, which produced monstrosities, the giants. It seems likely that the medieval insistence on and horrified fascination with the sexual relations of witches with the devil owes something to the legend of the Watchers. The story is the diabolical counterpart of a revered mystery of the Christian faith, the descent of the divine to a mortal woman and the birth of the Savior. Some of the early Christian fathers, including St. Augustine, rejected the legend of the Watchers and found the origin of evil in a revolt against God by a great archangel who rebelled through pride. Their scriptural authority was the famous passage in Isaiah which foretells the approaching doom of the king of Babylon. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nations? For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God, I will sit also in the mount of the congregation upon the sides of the north, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds, I will be like the Most High. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit. This was the foundation of the Christian doctrine of the devil's attempt to make himself the equal of God and his expulsion from heaven in punishment. As an explanation of the Satan's fall from grace, it had the advantage of fitting the tendency of later Jewish and Christian writers to exalt Satan's status to almost the position of an independent god. Lucifer, it was said, had been the archangel's name in heaven, and Satan was his name after his fall. This passage in Isaiah may refer to a legend of the beautiful morning star who walked in Eden, blazing in jewels and light, and in his insane pride attempted to rival God. Lucifer, son of the morning, is in Hebrew Hillel ben Shahar, day star, son of the dawn. The Jews, Arabs, Greeks, and Romans identified the morning star, the planet Venus, as male. In Greek it was called Phosphorus, and in Latin Lucifer, both words meaning light-bearer. It has been suggested that the story of Lucifer may have been based on the observation that the morning star is the last proud star to defy the sunrise, and the belief that it must have been punished for its defiance. The legends of Lucifer and the Watchers both find the origin of evil in the fall of divine beings driven to sin by pride or by lust and condemned to hell in punishment. It was natural for them to be combined, with the Watchers becoming Lucifer's followers. There are already hints of this possibility in 1 Enoch. In one passage, the Watchers are said to have been corrupted by the Satans, who led them astray and caused their sin, and in another, Azazel, the leader of the Watchers, is described as a star fallen from heaven. By the 1st century AD, Lucifer and Satan and the Watchers had all been connected together, and the Serpent of Eden had been added to the story. A book called 2nd Enoch says that the archangel Sataniel tried to make himself the equal of God and seduced the Watchers to rebel with him. They were all banished from heaven, and to revenge himself for his fall, Sataniel tempted Eve in Eden. According to the Vita Adi et Evi, Satan was expelled from his glory among the angels because he refused to worship Adam, which the angels were ordered to do by God. Michael told him that God would be angry, but Satan said, "If he be wroth with me, I will set my seat above the stars of heaven and will be like the highest." Then God hurled Satan and his followers down to earth, and Satan tempted Eve in revenge. Here, the devil's rebellion from pride is combined with the idea of angelic jealousy of man. There is no suggestion in Genesis that the serpent who tempted Eve was the devil, but Christian writers generally accepted that the serpent was either the devil's agent or the devil himself in disguise. On this basis, St. Paul constructed the central doctrine of Christianity that Adam's crime plunged all subsequent generations into the power of the devil and the toils of sin and death from which God sent his Son to release them. As Adam's disobedience brought death to men, so Christ's willing submission to death brought men eternal life. For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive. Jesus and his followers evidently believe that the devil has authority over this world, at least in the sense that he rules worldliness, luxury, and pride. During the temptation in the wilderness, according to St. Matthew, the devil showed Jesus all the kingdoms of this world and the glory of them, and said, in words which go to the heart of Satanism, "All these things will I give thee, if thou wilt fall down and worship me." In St. Luke, the devil specifically says that power over all the kingdoms of this world has been granted to him, "For that is delivered unto me, and to whomsoever I will, I give it." Jesus called the devil the prince of this world, and St. Paul called him the god of this world. Embarrassing use was later made of these passages by Gnostics, who maintained that the devil rules this world because he created it, and that God is far away. Another strand in the later picture of the devil was his identification with Leviathan, a monstrous primeval dragon or serpent which had challenged Jehovah. Isaiah says that God will punish Leviathan the piercing serpent, even Leviathan that crooked serpent. The legend of Jehovah's victory over Leviathan may be connected with Babylonian and Canaanite myths. In Babylon, the god Marduk's defeat of the great dragon Tiamat, who tried to overthrow the gods, was celebrated each year. In the Canaanite myth of Baal, the god kills the sea dragon Lothan, or Leviathan. When thou smotest Leviathan the slippery serpent, and madest an end of the wriggling serpent, the tyrant with seven heads. Leviathan and the devil, who are both opponents of God, both prideful, and both to be punished, are linked together in Revelation. A great red dragon appears with seven heads. The dragon's tail drew down a third of the stars and cast them to the earth. Quote, and there was war in heaven. Michael and his angels fought against the dragon, and the dragon fought, and his angels, and prevailed not. Neither was their place found any more in heaven. And the great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil, and Satan, which deceiveth the whole world. He was cast out into the earth, and his angels were cast out with him. Unquote. A voice from heaven is heard rejoicing because, quote, the accuser of our brethren is cast down, which accused them before our God day and night, unquote. And the voice cries, woe to the inhabitants of the earth, quote, for the devil is come down unto you, having great wrath, because he knoweth that he hath but a short time, unquote. In this tremendous vision, most of the main threads of the later Christian conception of the devil are drawn together. The Satan, who accused men before God, the war in heaven, with the forces of God led by Michael, the expulsion of Lucifer from heaven, the fallen angels or stars who were his followers, the seven-headed dragon Leviathan, and the belief that the devil's vengeful fury has been let loose on earth. It is not clear whether the description of the devil as a deceiver was meant to refer to the serpent of Eden, but the generations of Christians who knew this passage probably identified that old serpent as the subtle tempter of paradise. It was the Christians who gave the devil almost the position of a god. Convinced of the stainless goodness of God, they sensed and feared the presence of a great supernatural enemy, the quintessence of all evil. That the devil sinned through pride became and remains the orthodox Catholic belief. In the Middle Ages and the early modern world, the devil was a familiar reality. He figured in popular tales, stage plays, mumming dances. He was preached from pulpits. He leered or frowned from the walls and windows of churches. He and his legions were everywhere, subtle, knowing, malicious, and formidable. Evil has its own perverse allure, and the greater the powers with which the devil is credited, the more his attraction is increased. The devil, like God, has been constantly pictured in the image of man, and Christians have believed in the great archangel's revolt against God, in part at least, because it strikes a responsive chord in the human heart. Lucifer is man in rebellion, and his pride seems a more worthy explanation of the origin of evil, and is, paradoxically, less discreditable to the Prince of Darkness than the lust of the Watchers. The result has been the tendency to see the devil as a titanic romantic figure, as he is in Paradise Lost, the arch-rebel against authority, fearless, determined, defiant in the face of superior force, unhumbled in defeat, and to accord him a willing or unwilling admiration. With all the magnificence of the devil's pride and power, it is not surprising that some have attempted to enter his service. People who worship the devil do not regard him as evil. To the Satanist, the supernatural being who is the enemy of Christendom is a good and benevolent God. But the word good, applied to the devil by his followers, does not carry its Christian or conventional meanings. Satanists believe that what Christians call good is really evil, and vice versa, though there is an ambivalence of attitude in Satanism, as in black magic, a perverse pleasure in doing things which are felt to be evil, combined with a conviction that doing these things is really virtuous. Worship of the devil as a good god naturally involves the belief that the Christian God the Father, the God of the Old Testament, was and remains an evil god, hostile to man and the enemy of morality and truth. In full-blown Satanism, Jesus Christ is also condemned as an evil being, though sects accused of devil worship in the past have frequently not believed this. If God the Father and God the Son, the creators of Jewish and Christian law and ethics, are thought to be evil, the necessary result is a denial of the whole Judeo-Christian moral code and the conventional rules which are based on it. The followers of the devil are intensely excited by and preoccupied with sensual pleasure and worldly achievement. They admire pride, strength, and force. They revel in self-assertion and dominance, lust, dearth, violence, cruelty, and all passionate sensations. Christian piety, with its virtues of otherworldliness, self-denial, humility, cleanliness of heart and mind, they condemn as spineless, colorless, dead. They wholeheartedly echo Swinburne's accusing line, "Thou hast conquered, O pale Galilean, and the world has grown gray from thy breath." As in black magic generally, actions which are conventionally condemned as evil are valued for their psychological and mystical effects. Devil worshippers usually believe that the attainment of perfection and the experience of the divine come through an ecstasy achieved in a sensual orgy which is likely to involve perverse sexual practices, homosexuality, and flagellation, sometimes cannibalism. Because the Christian churches, especially the Roman Catholic, are regarded as abominable institutions devoted to the worship of an evil god, their ceremonies are parodied and degraded. Doing this is not merely to make a gesture in the devil's cause. It captures and twists to satanic uses the power which is believed to be inherent in the Christian rituals. Preoccupied with this world and this life, his worshippers believe that the devil rules the world, and that the immediate rewards of his service are pleasure and power. After death, they expect to be reborn on earth, or in some cases they hope to go rejoicing to a hell which is not an infernal torture chamber, but a place where all pleasures are intensified and the capacity to experience them greatly increased. They believe that the devil will eventually vanquish and overthrow the God of the Christians, and return in triumph to the heaven from which the Christian God wrongfully ejected him. In that day, Satan's faithful flock will reap their reward of eternal power and eternal bliss. Holding one or more of the beliefs which make up this pattern of Satanist theory has frequently been enough to bring down an accusation of devil worship. Many sects and groups have been accused of it, but genuine Satanists have probably always been rare as they are today. The accused sects cloaked themselves in secrecy to avoid persecution, and it is often impossible to tell whether they were consciously devoted to adoration of the Christian devil or not. Even the true character of witchcraft in Europe is still violently disputed, in spite of great quantities of evidence. But there is a common factor in the accusations made, justly or unjustly, against suspected devil worshippers: the reversal of Christian values. The early development of Satanist theory was influenced by widespread acceptance of dualism, the belief that opposing gods of good and evil exist independently of each other. By itself, dualism does not imply devil worship, but it creates a favorable background for it. There is more incentive to enlist in the devil's ranks if he is on more or less equal terms with God than if he is subordinate to God and acts only on God's sufferance, as in Orthodox Christian belief. The central belief of the Gnostic sects, accused of Satanism by Orthodox Christians, was dualist. For any Gnostic, it has been observed, the world is really hell. Convinced that the world is thoroughly evil, the Gnostics could not believe that it had been created by a good God. They thought that the supreme God, the principle of good, is far away in the distant heaven. The world was made and is governed by lesser deities called archons, rulers, who are either actively hostile to God or do not know that God exists. For some Gnostics, the archons were the gods of the planets, the guardians who barred the way to the human soul when it tried to ascend through the spheres after death. The chief of the archons was frequently identified with the God of the Old Testament, who was in Gnostic eyes an evil, savage, vindictive, and treacherous deity. According to their Christian opponents, Simon Magus and another Gnostic teacher, Menander, both believed that the world was made by archangels who were in rebellion against the supreme God. Saturninus, who taught at Antioch in the early 2nd century, said that the world was made by 7 rebellious angels led by the God of the Jews, who inspired Moses and the Old Testament prophets to lead mankind astray. Christian eyebrows were inevitably raised at this insistence on the wickedness of God the Father, and the belief that the world is ruled by rebel angels. But the Gnostics did not stop there. They believed that man was created by the archons, and is fundamentally evil, though he does contain the divine spark. Some said that the man the archons fashioned could not stand up and wriggled about on the ground like a large helpless worm. The Supreme God took pity on him and sent down the divine spark which gave the poor creature human life and an erect posture. Theories of this kind struck at the roots of Christianity. For if man was evil from the beginning and did not fall from grace in Eden, Christ could not have come to atone by death for man's fall. Pursuing this train of thought enthusiastically, some Gnostics identified Jehovah as the devil. Others said that the devil was a good angel, an opponent of Jehovah and the Archons. They reversed all the Old Testament values, condemning the patriarchs and prophets, and praising Jehovah's opponents. In Gnostic theory, the serpent of Eden was a savior, sent by the supreme God to teach Adam and Eve the knowledge of good and evil, so that they could see the evil nature of the world Jehovah had created. Some Gnostics admired Cain, and pointed out that his peaceable offering of crops was rejected, while Abel's blood sacrifice was accepted, because the evil lord of this world delights in blood. Other Gnostics referenced the Sodomites, Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, Pharaoh and the Egyptians, and all those condemned in the Bible for worshipping other gods and failing to walk in the ways of Jehovah. Some went so far as to condemn Jesus as the son of the evil Jehovah and glorify Judas Iscariot for ridding the world of this incubus. The majority believed that Jesus was a divine savior who came to free men from the God of the Jews. But even so, their views were so unorthodox as to smell strongly of sulfur and brimstone. According to Saint Irenaeus, in his book Against Heresies, written in the late 2nd century, Saturninus taught that Jesus was not really crucified. Simon of Cyrene was executed in his place, while Jesus stood by invisibly and watched, laughing. It followed that anyone who professed the crucified had been fooled by the Archons and remained a slave to them, while whoever denied him knew the true disposition of things and was free of the Archons. To these drastic reversals of Christian beliefs, some Gnostics added a corresponding reversal of Jewish and Christian moral standards. The general Gnostic emphasis on knowledge, received through an inspiration from God, as the only key to the divine, naturally led to a contempt for conventional morality, because a man did not reach heaven by leading a good life, but through possession of the Gnosis. Some Gnostics led lives of severe austerity to free themselves from the tangles of the wicked world. They particularly detested the procreation of children, for it added to the stock of human lives enslaved to the Archons. But others took the opposite course. The followers of Valentinus, Irenaeus says, believed that a man who had received the Gnosis had become spiritual substance, a god in effect, and could not be corrupted by anything he might do. Secure in Godhead, they seduced their female disciples and indulged all the lusts of the flesh with the utmost greediness. Similarly, the followers of Simon Magus led profligate lives and practiced magic. The Gnostics could argue that there was a positive virtue in evil living. For them, the world was thoroughly evil, and its accepted moral codes had been invented by the Archons to keep men in subjection. The evil Jehovah had delivered the law and commandments to Moses and inspired the harangues of the prophets. The way to escape from slavery, to frustrate the scheme of the Archons and attain salvation, was to break all the conventional rules. Some Gnostics apparently carried this idea to a point which does not fit with their dualistic tendencies, but which is close to the heart of magical theory. They said that good and evil are meaningless labels, and that the way to perfection is to experience everything. For they maintain, Irenaeus says of Gnostics who held that the world had been created by the devil, that things are evil or good simply in virtue of human opinion. They deem it necessary, therefore, that by means of transmigration from body to body, soul should have experience of every kind of life as well as every kind of action, so that their souls, having made trial of every kind of life, may at their departure not be wanting in any particular. Transmigration from body to body was necessary unless in one life the adept could do all those things which we dare not either speak or hear of, nay, which we must not even conceive in our thoughts. All these Gnostic ideas fit into the general pattern of Satanism. Indeed, they largely established it. There is no evidence that any of the Gnostics consciously worshipped the devil, but it is not surprising that Orthodox Christians thought they did. After the triumph of Christianity and its adoption as the state religion of the Roman Empire, Gnostic theories were kept alive by obscure heretical sects in the East and were eventually transmitted into Western Europe. The principal sects involved in this process seem to have been the Messalians of Armenia, who moved slowly westwards after the 4th century and reached the Balkans by the 11th century, the Paulicians, who flourished in Armenia and Asia Minor from the 5th century and were deported to the Balkans in 872, and the Bogomils, who were well entrenched in Bulgaria by about 950, seem to have drawn many of their doctrines from the Paulicians and Messalians and spread westwards in their turn. In the 12th century, the principal Bogomil centers were in Bosnia, northern Italy, and southern France. They seem to have acquired a dominating influence over the Cathars, from Greek Katharoi the Pure, whose first communities had appeared in the north of Italy in the early 11th century. 100 years later, the south of France was riddled with Catharism, which was supported by many of the local nobility. The first Cathar bishop in northern France established himself there about 1150, and the movement penetrated into Flanders and western Germany. In 1167, a Bogomil bishop traveled through northern Italy and southern France, visiting the Cathar faithful and setting up new bishoprics. The Cathars said that the god of the Old Testament was Satan, the lord of this world which he created. He governed the human body, death, and all material and temporal things. Some thought he was originally a fallen angel, but others took the dualist view that he had existed as an independent rival of the true God since the beginning of time and would continue to exist for all eternity. The moral views of the Cathars were also highly obnoxious to Orthodox Christians. Like many Gnostics earlier, they thought it sinful to procreate children, which replenishes the stock of the devil's world, and they observed that the command to be fruitful and multiply was given to Adam and Eve by Satan, Jehovah. Their high adepts, the perfect, who were reverenced as embodiments of Christ by the faithful, another danger signal in Orthodox eyes, lived in strict austerity, refraining from sex, violence, all food of animal origin, lying, owning property, and taking oaths. But the lower ranks of Cathars, who were far more numerous, did not observe these rules. On the contrary, they were enslaved to the devil in any case, and nothing they did could very well harm them. It was better for them to indulge their lusts casually than to marry, for marriage was an abomination designed to produce children. Besides encouraging debauchery, the Cathars were accused of believing that any form of sexual intercourse which would not lead to the conception of a child was preferable to one which would, and they were suspected of unnatural vice. This is how the word bougre, originally applied to Cathars, to mean Bulgarian, that is, Bogomil, acquired its modern meaning. The fact that the male perfect lived together in pairs, and the female perfect likewise, stimulated accusations of homosexuality. The Cathars believed themselves to be the true Church of Christ. They denounced the Church of Rome as an institution of the devil, not only because it worshipped a god they identified as Satan, but because they thought it infected through and through with the worldliness and fleshly indulgence which the devil ruled and delighted in. The Roman Catholics returned the compliment with interest. It seemed clear that a sect which encouraged vice and reversed so many accepted Christian values must be in league with the evil one. Additional evidence of Satanism was found in the fact that when a Cathar was initiated as one of the perfect, he formally renounced the Roman Church and his Catholic baptism. If this was not already a stock requirement for enlisting in the devil's service, it became one. Whether any of the Cathars did worship the devil is not known. It is possible that some of them concluded that if the Catholic God was really the devil, then the Catholic devil might be the true God. In any event, Rome was convinced that they did, and in the early 13th century, Pope Innocent III organized an armed crusade against the Cathars in the south of France. They were accused of adoring the devil in the form of a goat or a cat at meetings which Catholics called Synagogues of Satan, from Revelation 2:9. Under torture, some of them confessed to this, and to singing songs to the devil, slaughtering stolen children, and drinking potions made from their bodies. They flew through the air to their meetings on broomsticks or poles smeared with oil, while devils took their places at home. The same accusations were later made against witches. Several other sects preserved dualist and Gnostic beliefs, probably influenced directly or indirectly by the Bogomils and Cathars. About 1125, a French peasant called Clémentius of Bussy taught that the altar of a Catholic church was the mouth of hell and that it was sinful to marry and beget children. His followers were said to avoid this sin by devoting themselves to homosexuality and lesbianism, but they did hold occasional promiscuous orgies. Babies born as a result of these were burned, and a communion bread was made from their remains. In 1184, the Waldensians, or Vaudois, who still survive in Europe as a Protestant sect, came under the anathema of Rome. They were accused of worshipping the devil and holding orgiastic meetings at night, at which a dog appeared and sprinkled the worshippers with its tail. Also accused of cannibalism, they acquired such a reputation that sorcery became popularly known in France as vauderie, and witches as vaudoises, and this is the origin of the word voodoo. Early in the next century, rumors circulated of the hideous satanic rites practiced by a sect in Germany called Luciferans, and in 1227, the Pope sent Conrad of Marburg to root out heresy and reform the church in Germany. Conrad was a sadistic fanatic who had been spiritual director of St. Elizabeth of Thuringia and had delighted in beating and humiliating her. He descended on the Luciferans in the fierce conviction that he was called to do battle with Satan himself. The confessions he extracted were apparently made without torture, but under the threat of death if the victim did not confess. If these confessions were accurate, the Luciferans were full-blown Satanists. They worshipped the devil as creator and ruler of the world, complained that he had been unjustly and treacherously banished from heaven, and believed that he would overthrow the God of the Christians and return to heaven when they would enjoy eternal happiness with him. They reveled in whatever displeased the Christian God and hated whatever pleased him. At Easter they would go to Mass, keep the consecrated hosts in their mouths, and spit them out into a cesspool to show their contempt for Christ. When a man was initiated as a Luciferan, he was taken to one of their meetings and made to kiss a toad on its backside or mouth. Or sometimes the thing he kissed looked like a duck or a goose and was the size of an oven. Then there came to him a man with black eyes who was pale, emaciated, and icy cold. Possibly he represented the devil as Lord of Death. The initiate kissed him and lost his Catholic faith in that instant. Then everyone sat down to a feast, and a large black cat appeared, emerging from a statue which was always present. The initiate, the leader of the group, and any other members who were worthy of the honor kissed the cat's backside. The leader said, "What does this teach?" A member answered, "The highest peace," and another added, "And that we must obey." The candles were put out, and there was an indiscriminate heterosexual and homosexual orgy. Afterwards, the candles were relit, and the figure of a man appeared from a dark corner. The upper part of his body shone like the sun, but from the hips down he was black like the cat. The leader cut off a piece of the initiate's clothing and gave it to the shining man, saying, "Master, I give this to you which has been given to me." The shining man answered, "You have served me well. You will serve me more and better. I leave to your care what you have given to me." Then he disappeared. This account of an initiation carries a certain conviction, and it could have been stage-managed without too much difficulty. There are traces in modern times of a tradition among witches that Lucifer, the light-bearer, was the sun, an identification which could easily be made when the devil was regarded as the ruler of life on earth. The shining man may perhaps have been intended to represent the devil as both the sun of daytime, the shining upper half of the figure, and the sun of night, the black lower parts standing for the black sun, passing under the earth through the regions of darkness before the next sunrise. The black sun can be imagined as the leader of the stars, which follow his course towards the western horizon and disappear beyond it, the stars fallen from heaven. The obscene kiss on the backside of an animal or person representing Satan became a stock charge in allegations of devil worship, but where it originally came from is not known. It was evidently a symbol of utter submission, and perhaps also of the reversal of conventional values. Conrad of Marburg was assassinated in 1233, but the hunt for Satanists continued. About 1286, Pope Honorius IV ordered the persecution of a group of German heretics who preached that men and women ought to refrain from wearing clothes and working with their hands. This would restore them to the state of innocent perfection enjoyed by Adam and Eve in Eden. The belief was considered dangerous because its adherents frequently condemned marriage and it encouraged vice. It has bobbed up now and again in Europe and the United States, and is perhaps the origin of the notion that nudism is physically and psychologically healthy. In 1925, Adamites were discovered near Oroville, California. Anna Rhodes, the priestess of the cult, believed that she and her husband were Eve and Adam, and their home, the Garden of Eden, recreated. The sect held naked orgies in the Rhodes farmyard, dancing round a bonfire and sacrificing animals. On at least one occasion, a lamb was burned alive, though whether this was a deliberate blasphemy, the lamb being a symbol of Christ, is not clear. In 1307, French and English members of the Order of Knights Templar were tried on charges of worshipping the devil in the form of a cat, worshipping an idol and wearing girdles which had touched the idol's head, renouncing Christ, the Virgin, and the saints, stamping, spitting, or urinating on crucifixes, homosexual vice, and ritual homosexuality on admission to the order. The candidate kissed his leader, and kisses were exchanged on the navel, the anus, the base of the spine, or the phallus. It was also said that they did not believe in the Eucharist, and that the order's priests omitted the hoc est corpus meum, this is my body, from the canon of Mass. Large numbers of Templars confessed to some of the charges, especially to those of renouncing Christ, insulting the cross, obscene kissing, and homosexual vice. Some confessed under torture, some without torture, but probably in fear of it. Most of them afterwards denied that their confessions were true. The Grand Master of the Order and the Preceptor of Normandy repudiated their confessions before being burned alive in Paris in 1314. The idol which the Templars were accused of worshipping was said to be a human head with curly black hair. It was named Baphomet, possibly a corruption of Mahomet. Some said it was the head of the first Grand Master who made us and has not left us. Covered with gold and jewels, it was pale and frightening to look at. The girdles which had touched the head were peculiarly sinister because they suggested a link with the Cathars. The Cathar Perfect originally wore black robes with a cord as a girdle. To escape notice during the persecution, they took to wearing ordinary clothes with a cord concealed beneath them. It was this connection which sent a chill down people's spines at the mention of the little cord of the Templars. In 1388, the Inquisition tortured a man who revealed the activities of a group of Waldensians near Turin. They worshipped the great dragon of Revelation, the creator of the world, who on earth is more powerful than God. They said that Christ was a mere mortal, son of Joseph, and not son of God. They held religious services followed by orgies, and on initiation the candidate had to drink a potion made of toad's excrement, which was so powerful that he could never afterwards leave the sect. In 1453, a sect of Brethren of the Cross was discovered in Thuringia. They practiced flagellation and believed that Satan would regain his lost power and place and would expel Christ from heaven. They celebrated orgies in secret by night. Early in the following century, it was said that Bohemia was infested with thousands of Luciferans. In Italy, Pope Julius II ordered an inquisitor to proceed against a certain sect which renounced the Christian faith, trampled on and dishonored crosses, abused the sacraments, especially the Eucharist, and took the devil as their lord and master, offering him obedience and reverence. By the 16th century, the searchlights of persecution were being turned away from the Luciferans and similar heretical sects to be trained on the witches. Many of the sects had been accused of holding secret meetings at night and worshipping the devil, usually in the form of a man, cat, or goat. Some were specifically charged with believing that the devil rules this world and will eventually overthrow God. Even when these accusations were lacking, Other heretical practices were classed as Satanist because they reversed Christian values. Renunciation of Christianity and hostility to the church, condemnation of marriage and procreation, slaughtering of children and cannibalism, orgiastic sexual practices and homosexuality. Most of this pattern of Satanism reappears in the witch trials.